We are here with Fran Wozniak. Wozniak, that's the Apple.
Wozniak. Yeah.
Wozniak. Woz for short. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. It's March in South Carolina. We don't get much snow in South Carolina, but in March, we get plenty of the green and yellow stuff in the form of pollen. So it's a great time of year. Don't wash your cars. You don't have to pressure wash your windows. Most of your dogs, if you have a black dog, it's going to come in look like a bumblebee. And Flonase is a number one hit here. So other than that, it's pretty good. It's pretty good. So
Flonase is now a natural resource.
It is. Yeah, it's I think there's a shortage on Flonase and Ozempic in this country these days. So
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, here in the desert side of Washington, we've had more moisture than I'm used to. And so I've got to go get, for money wise, I've switched over to using like a vinegar salt mixture for weed killer. Okay, way cheaper than Roundup. And I've got to go through all my rocks because I got grass and all sorts of stuff grown, which is not like here. So
does the vinegar salt mixture actually work?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Really? I'm gonna do that because there's too much. You know, Roundup is the Camp Lejeune mesothelioma of today. There's all those lawyers commercials with it.
And yeah.
Plus, I don't like it. It kills all the wrong things. I think it hurts the bumblebees and the bees and stuff like that too. So, and I'm not a member of Greenpeace by any means, but I also understand the importance of bees in our ecosystem. So I'm gonna try that. I'm gonna see how that works on, especially dandelions. I don't want to kill the clover in the yard because that's what makes my lawn green, but I could definitely get rid of the dandelions and the purple onions. So I'm going to try that out, see how that works. I'll look it up on the Google and get the mixtures right for it, the proportions. So nice. Good tip.
Yeah. I started using it last year. Worked really well. I will say your house will, your property will smell like vinegar for about an hour or two, but I mean, whatever.
Oh, that's fine. I mean, they could smell like worse things.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So yard work aside though, this spring brings us back to IASIS in Orlando here at the last week of April, first week of May.
Yep.
And, what are we looking forward to with IASIS this year?
We say it every year, but every year it holds true. It is going to be the best and the largest event yet. Student wise, I know we increased our, don't quote me on the exact number of staff. We increased our staff. We added more specialized classes. So I think last year we were maybe at 900 to 1,000 people. We're talking estimates, 200 staff, 700 students. I think we're going to be over 1,000 this year, 1,000 participants. That includes the volunteers, which of course are the staff and the students. We added an advanced mobile class, which is, I think, going to go into database queries and into scripting and things of that nature. I spoke to several members of that team, and that's going to be advanced. I think that's going to be 2 1-week classes. I do not think that basic mobile has to be a prerequisite. But I would suggest that because our basic mobile is not basic by any means whatsoever. So the advanced mobile class, and as well as the normal slew of classes, and then the vendors. I believe the vendors are offering more classes this year as well. So we've definitely are outgrowing that conference center. But luckily they have that whole new wing, so we're starting to invade that whole new wing down there in the center. So looking forward to it. So it's gonna be a good year.
So we're there the second week. I might like just abandon my post and just go sit through that advanced mobile class, Now, SQLite is one of my what I call my nerd hobbies.
Yeah.
SQLite and Python. So any class that's going to teach on that, I love it. I love it. And just offhand and putting you on the spot here, about outside of the main certification course for the CFCE, how many classes are running, give or take, each week?
Let me go off the Cypher, which is our network intrusion class. You're going to have MDF, mobile device forensics, advanced mobile device forensics, Windows Forensic Examiner. We have a lab certification course. It's not to get certified. It's to teach you how to get your lab to be accredited, certified, whichever.
Sure.
And then we have a scripting class. I'm trying to think what else. You did put me on the spot here, and then if I forget the class, somebody's going to say, "Hey, you forgot our class." I'm just trying to go. I could picture it by rooms in the in the actual conference center rather than the list itself. I know the vendors, of course, Cellebrite's there with their classes. Spider Forensics is there with their classes. The certifications are going to be in BCFE, Windows Forensic Examiner, and in mobile device forensics. So those are the certification classes.
That's awesome.
And then please forgive me if I forgot a class.
We put you on the spot, and it's always tough. Like, I probably could ask you your kids' names and you'd forget one. So, you know, I know I would. So yeah, no worries there. What I wanted to illustrate to everybody is there is a lot going on. It's a diverse crew, a diverse class set. And what I love about it is that it's all, or I'm not going to say all, I'm going to say mostly the core forensic stuff, the stuff you need to know about computing, the stuff you need to know about forensics, the hex, the file structures. I know I work for a vendor. I mean, full disclosure, I think we know, but
right.
A lot of forensics you need to know past the button, you know, you need to know past the software.
Absolutely. And OSINT, open source. That's another class we have. And I do believe it's also a forensics real world, where they take a real life scenario, not classroom scenario, and they go through the class there. Those are two others. When they come in, I'm going to drop names, so I'm covered.
You got it.
All our classes are, nothing's push button. Everything is you got to crawl. You and I have talked about this before in our last podcast and off camera. It's everything is you're digging in the dirt virtually, of course, you know, but it's you're crawling before you learn how to walk. So you're learning the math before you get to use a calculator, and all our classes are like, that's essential. Yeah. We're not, it's important. It can be painful at times. It absolutely is, but it saves you down the road. It makes you a better product. It makes you a better examiner. And you know, whether you like it or not, we're saving the students from themselves. We're making them a better product. When they sit on the stand, the court stand, they're testifying, they have it. They're going to thank us. Everybody's thankful then when you could give a solid answer and you have, you know, the knowledge behind it to back it up. So that's key. That's paramount. So, yeah.
Yep. I'm not in our support department, but I sit in the chats, and a lot of the support tickets that come through are less about our software and more about not understanding what the software is doing or why they're seeing a thing. And you're like, well, you know, this is what the hex is saying, and this is what this is saying. And if you knew how to read that stuff, you would know what was going on. And there's a real need for that kind of training. So
correct. Yes. And then it has to continue to happen. Problem is, I mean, it's good for the software companies. You guys are getting more advanced. Everything's almost becoming automated to the point where it's dangerous enough that a department maybe can afford the software. They can't afford the training. So they just go in there and they just, like, you know, they work in a microwave, just do and set it and forget it. Crockpot forensics. And they got nothing. They got nothing behind it to testify to. So that's a very dangerous game.
Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about that here in a little bit.
Yes.
But I know we're here excited to go to IASIS. After I went, so last year was my first time going to the conference, and because unfortunately, while I was in law enforcement, couldn't get approval and anything to go, but was really impressed with the conference. Came back, talked to, you know, the people here. I'm like, we have to go back again next year and be a vendor and be supportive of that community. Mm-hmm. And so I know this year. Well, one of the things people may not know is IASIS is very student. Well, they know they're very student focused, but even when it comes to the vendor, you guys are super student focused. It's more about how are you going to help the student, right? Yep, what are you going to do for them?
Yep.
How, you know, a lot of these people, especially in the certification programs, are starting out, right? They're newer.
Yes.
Mostly. And so what are you going to do to help them? And I took that message back here to Extero, and I was like, hey, a lot of these people are brand new, looking to whatever. So I know this year for the sponsorship, that's how you guys do a lot of things, is what are you going to donate? How are you going to help people out? We're giving out full year licenses of our software to everyone in the certification program.
Yep.
This year, plus that's training and some other stuff. So, you know, we really wanted to embrace the community in that way and support you guys, because to the point, you know, FTK is no different. A lot of our stuff is, we have the low level stuff, but we're very much building stuff so that it can be push button. Full transparency.
Oh, sure.
But we want to embrace that low level training.
So, no. Yeah. 100%. Number one, given the students, the software, that's a win-win for everybody. The students get to sample the product. And of course, you know, more people sample it, obviously that's just simple math. The more customers you're gonna get, you know, that's smart business. Number two, I'm not against push button forensics. Just the same, like I'm not against using a calculator, or it's as long as you know what you're doing. You know, use push button forensics to make your job easier. Just know, you know, as long as you know what you're doing, and you can validate some findings. All you got to do is validate. If you're working a murder case or a CSAM case, yeah, you don't have to validate every single thing you had. I would do some key points, some important findings, and just validate it yourself just by going through the database. That's it. You know, 2, 3, 4 validations. And nobody's going to question you more than that. And then that's easy. Yeah, I do push button forensics all day long, but I do validate my findings of them that are of importance. You know, the same reason why I take a picture. If I have a mobile phone and I do a mobile phone extraction, I do my reports and all my findings, I'll still take a picture of the phone, you know, with maybe the contacts up or the phone logs or anything like that to show that this is the phone that I actually worked on. The picture I took validates the forensic report that I have. Simple as that. So, and all, you know, that's just, a little goes a long way. So, yeah.
No, for sure. Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the little goes a long way, and we're talking about push button, and that's kind of been the iteration is, you know, we rewind, it was Norton disk edit or whatever, you know, very manual, very, you got to do it. And we're starting to move into more of a review set push button kind of world. Still want to know, but I mean, we can't ignore it. AI is kind of this clickbait term right now.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to throw it to you first. What are you thinking about AI as its impact on the forensic workflows and the forensic practice?
Well, I have some talking points on this because I actually went over it today. It is a natural progression. You can't, you know, it's like trying to stop the railroad from happening in the 1800s or, you know, the telephone from happening. It's happening whether we like it or not. So you're just gonna have to go with the flow with it, but also understand that there are limitations. There are absolute limitations of AI as of right now. I'm not talking 50 years from now, but I'm talking as of right now and in the immediate future. You can work in conjunction with AI, but you actually have to do most of the work with you. It's great for a quick find, you know, triage something real quick, get that information out, but then go back and actually do your full examination. But the AI has a problem with, it does have a certain limit of parameters, okay? And of course it grows every day, but it doesn't have the human mind, it doesn't have the human ingenuity mindset to put certain pieces together. It's still a robot it doesn't express human judgment where you could say, well, no, this wouldn't happen. It doesn't know human behavioral issues as much as humans do, where a human could put, human eyes can put things together. They could click different points together. It's not as well as interpretation. I mean, you could go make a picture of something right now. AI is incapable of the human language. It cannot put a human language as far as I've seen right now. If you try to have like a saying, it looked like it's Star Wars language on there, you know, and it's a lot of the stuff is still a little wonky with it, whereas the human mind, and we'll go on to this a little bit with the detective mindset, but it's not quite there. It's great in some terms as far as getting it out quick to the investigator. You got a missing person, a murder suspect on the run, anything like that. Yeah, you can do a quick triage on it, get it out, and then do your deep dive, continue on. As of right now, that's how I see it. It's going to get better. It's going to get more in depth. So
I agree with that. I was just listening to Sam Altman, who's the CEO of OpenAI, who's kind of the developers, publishers of the big ChatGPTs that are out. And he was talking about how it's kind of interesting, his take on his own product. I wonder what he's seen behind the scenes, but he also kind of sees where it's going. because he seems rather unimpressed with where we are right now. And he referred to the GPTs as a simple tool.
Yeah.
And referred to it as something that, yes, we can use to help in our lives, but it's not truly, he even said it's not transformative yet, which I thought was interesting. And, but that's, I think you're right. We can use it as an aid. I like your comparison earlier of like, even with push button, like a calculator. Yeah. I feel like that's kind of the stage that these large language models and stuff are in, is the calculator stage. Where, you know, before we're doing math on paper, whatever you want to say, the ability and the advent of the calculator kind of brought math to the masses.
Yes.
Sped up a lot of things. Yes. And I think that's the stage we're in with AI. We just need to understand and kind of keep it in its box a little bit. Use it for what it's meant for.
It does have to be contained. And the other thing too with it is, as of right now, you and I are in the business, so we talk about it every day. So we do have a higher understanding of it than a jury would. Okay. A jury is not going to accept, well, you know, I ran this through an AI, found this, this, and this, and this. You know, you yourself have to say, I saw this, I found this, I did this to a jury. That's right now one of the biggest pros in a human digital forensics world is the fact that we have to get on the stand and explain, you know, to the jury, to the prosecutor, to the defense, and have the judge listen to it, not iRobot on the stand. So the whole point of everything is the big show, the potential trial at the end, and making sure that the end factor follows through, guilty, not guilty. That's out of our hands. We're just there to discover the facts and report them. But it's a human that has to do that. So AI can find it. But the human's going to have to validate it to make sure this robot, like I said, you know, they can't create pictures with the English language. You know, you're going to have a dog with two muzzles, you know, something like that. There's always something wonky with it. There's always something a little off with it. And it even has, you know, disclaimers, it has disclaimers on all the time that it can be wrong, you know, so, and that's not going to be fixed anytime soon. That's a long way. You know, you wouldn't trust AI to fly your plane right now with humans on it, you know? No. Yeah. You know, would you get on, you know, a plane with two robots flying? Doubtful. Yeah. It lacks the human judgment. It lacks the human, you know, creativity and intuition. So that's the same thing translates to our line of work and any line of work that would use AI for that.
You know, you kind of jumped ahead of the question in my mind, because I was going to ask you at the beginning of that, what do you think are the good applications of AI in forensics? And I think you nailed it with one little comment. It's great at finding the things.
Yes.
And then, you know, we're there to tell the story of the stuff that it's found. And I do think that's helpful.
It does. And it really does. It enhances the effectiveness and the efficiency of our findings. And that's the thing. It absolutely, at the speed of light, can do something that would take us hours to do, can do it exponentially quicker. You know, that's the efficiency. Just, again, it all comes down to validation. It can have a whole episode just on validating alone. And just do that. Just make sure your findings are accurate, or the findings of AI are accurate. And you could cut down on some time, especially like if you're looking for, you know, a particular, actually like a targeted, you know, examination of something where you have a known victim, you have a known suspect, a certain date that is only in question. That's just smart science to use all the resources capable. Just double check your work. That's all. You know, proof, you got proof, or you don't hand in a paper without proofreading it. Of course, you know, I don't even think that little, that little paper clip is still there, but, you know, you're still going to have. You're going to want to get rid of all those red squiggly lines and the unknown blue squigglies that nobody knows what that thing is. But yeah, so you're just always double checking your work. That's you learn that in the second grade. So same applies.
That brings up kind of a thought, is that's going to be the real risk here, because I mean, you're working cases still, and I worked like, time is the one thing you're always on crunch for. There's always that next case. There's always a stack of cases piling up. And I think that's going to be the temptation and the risk of AI, or even, we can even simplify it down just to any, is, oh, you know, it found some CSAM, or it found some texts or whatever. I'm just going to ship it. You know, you can get into that kind of mode where you trust it too much and aren't looking for the red squiggly lines or the blue squigglies that nobody knows what it means.
That's dangerous, but it's the same concept. It's a little bit elevated technology-wise, though. You work for a software company, and great software company. I have no problems with any of them. It's you cannot keep up with the apps on the phone. You know, AI is going to be the same. AI is going to be on the same relative page as that. So it's up to the human examiner to go into the databases and find what the apps could not get. It's happened to you. It's happened to me. Nothing against the software engineers or the developers. They're just always playing catch up because it's not like these 1 million plus apps, you know, have to disclose to each software company, hey, this is the update we did. No. So you're constantly playing catch up. Well, sometimes, you know, you can't wait for it. You know, the information's there. It's just that the software didn't parse it out. So you got to go ahead and dive in there yourself and find it. And sometimes your findings are not going to be in one database. You're going to have to either build the query or go in, connect the three databases together and somehow put it together in a format where the prosecution's going to understand what you did. And they're going to have to put it in colorful format to, you know, show the jury, to show your work. So that's the same thing. It's just, you need to dive in there sometimes and find, that just happened to me a couple of weeks ago. Go into a database, which actually was a very common one. It just so happens that some stuff was not pulled and I was able to dig it out and, you know, bada bing, bada boom, everything was good to go. It was a simple find, but simple success story, but still something that the software never would have pulled. Yeah. And then if you just left it to that, you would have gave it to somebody and you missed a crucial piece of evidence. Crucial. But yeah, so.
It's been a thing for a while, you know, validate, but also to your point, I remember we had a vendor that we used and we would get stuff updates. We would say, hey, you know, this thing or that thing is not being parsed. And they would say, hey, we'll get it to you in a month, which is an insane turnaround time. Like, that's awesome. But it was still too long. And it was like, okay, well, thank you. And, you know, that'll be awesome. We appreciate your effort. But we would still be in the database doing it ourselves for that case because, well, I don't have a month to sit on it. Yeah. But it's always going to be that arms race of, you know, and then, of course, you've got the privacy element that comes in where apps add encryption and stuff. And you
deal with that. Absolutely. Yep. That's more and more. That's happening more and more. And I think the next Windows operating system or the one after that, it's going to come with full, no matter what, everything's going to be encrypted. Almost like what's the word I'm looking for? Not by default, where the user can, you know, disable it or enable it. This one's going to come. Rumors fly that it's going to come fully like that. You know, we got freaked out when BitLocker first came out, and we're still surviving. We're still here. We're still collecting paychecks. So it's just something relying on you guys to come up with the science to help us, you know, get through it. So,
you know, it'll be interesting with that because I've heard that rumor as well with Windows 12 or whatever they're going to call it, being file-based encryption or file system-based encryption and all this stuff. It's interesting because I know, like, those of us that like computers and are in them and all that sort of stuff, like, we get encryption and we understand the whatever, but I always wonder, like, when you have, you know, someone, my grandma wonders why she can't get her photos back because she knocked her laptop off the table and the system is damaged and I can't just image her drive and get it back. It's kind of, do you remember a few years ago, I say a few, but it's probably been 10 or 12 now, when Western Digital came out with those, like, they were the external drives and the chipset in them encrypted them and you had to be in the enclosure for them to work. Then the enclosure would get damaged and people couldn't get their photos. Well, that drive didn't last very long. And that's why I always wonder, like, with the mainstream audience, how always on encryption will be for them.
And that's the thing, the common user, the maybe half our audience will understand this reference, the folks with the VCR flashing 12. All right. Those people still exist. They don't have VCRs flashing 12 anymore, but
it's the microwave.
But you still have that. So the common user is they're going to be annoyed. They have nothing to hide. You know, you're right. They have family photos. They do TurboTax once a year. email, what have you not, just simple, recipes or something like that. They're going to get bored, frustrated, and tired with everything just always being encrypted, security measure this, security measure that. Now, obviously the aficionados, the people we deal with on a daily basis, professionally, of course, are going to want something like that, but we're talking, pennies of the dollar as far as the consumer goes. So they just, we'll see. I don't know. I think if it's going to be mandatory like that, that they may run into some problems with that. I think they should keep it voluntary. But also, Bill Gates has I don't know how many private jets, and I'm looking to buy a pickup truck. So it's who's right, who's wrong in this matter. That's remains to be seen. To be determined.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, we're kind of on a tangent, but I want to dive down where we're kind of headed. So let's say that the idea is that they're going to full disk encryption because for backup, they want to push people to the cloud.
Yeah.
That could have a big impact on how we do forensics in general, because it could be a lot of warrants and subpoenas and court orders, and then reading through PDF outputs and stuff.
Yeah, 100%. And real quick, just to talk a little bit about me. I was kind of there, but not quite. I said there would be no such thing as anybody would never own their own computer. There would just be standalone stations like payphones everywhere. And you would have a thumb drive, and you'd plug your thumb drive into that standalone station wherever. And that thumb drive would do everything and would be pushed out to a server somewhere. And I don't even know if the cloud existed. I'm sure it did in 2006, 7. I'm sure obviously there was some use value for it, but it wasn't like the big, the big explosion of cloud-based systems we have now. I was a little off because we don't have, and I think that was because of the cyber cafes were big and stuff like that. And I thought everything would just be, just plug in a little thumb drive and that's going to be your computer that does everything to you to the cloud. But with the cloud, I mean, with search warrants and stuff like that, it's not too bad. And I know, softwares are doing cloud analysis and stuff like that. The legal ramifications, I would definitely get something on paper from your prosecuting, powers that be before you started rooting around in somebody's, cloud-based systems. That's a big Fourth Amendment issue. That's pretty much the equivalent of their residence, if I had to say so. So you got to make sure you got your ducks in a row before you start, invading somebody's Facebook account or any of the clouds. I'm talking live acquisitions getting in there. You could always write a search warrant to Apple, to Google, and they're going to send you all the records. It's going to be very convoluted, and you're going to have to find a way to decode everything, unzip, decode, and then interpret. But I'm talking as far as cloud forensics. That's a big time. Get something on paper before you start rooting around in there. That's just me. I just like to throw caution to the wind. You're going to do 80 hours worth of work and get it thrown out. Do a 20-minute meeting with your prosecutor and get it all squared away before you go for it.
Yeah. Do you think, I was taking on this tangent just because I want to ask, do you think we just had a news article, I should have looked it up, but we're on a tangent, so I don't have it ready. Google just anonymized their map data so that even if you served a warrant to Google for map data, allegedly, they couldn't give it to you.
Yeah.
What's the implications of that combined with, encryption? It sounds like it could get pretty sketchy. Not in the near future. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, but
Yeah, that's the same thing when Apple did their full thing where they couldn't recover anything. And Apple's like, we can't even get to anything. They started that, let's see, 2019, 18, maybe-ish, maybe off by a year or two. And then I noticed every bad guy's phone went from an Android to an iPhone. And so I think with them doing that with the mapping, I think there'll be a workaround somehow. Both Google and Apple aren't law enforcement friendly. Yeah, that's fine. And like I always said, as an American citizen, as a private citizen, that's great. I'll use your product. But from my day job, it's frustrating. It's frustrating. But we're police officers. I mean, you get lazy when you get comfortable. So there's always a way. There's always a way. There's always a workaround. If you don't do it, somebody else is going to do it, and they're going to tell everybody how to do it. So I'm not too worried about it. It is an inconvenience, but inconveniences happen every day. So it's not that. It's going to be something else, and it probably will be something else in conjunction with it. Just adapt, and move on, move forward. So
you just got to get over it. Yeah.
Yeah. Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah.
So life's too short to stress about that.
That, yeah.
So, So speaking of that, and kind of diving back into what we're going to talk about in a way, warrants may be writing warrants or applying for warrants may become a lot more. I mean, it's a big part of your job now, but it could become a larger part. What do you think kind of about using these large language models to assist in like the writing of warrants or affidavits or stuff like that? Do you think it's a dangerous application? Used right, it's okay. Like, where do you fall on that spectrum?
No, I actually, I tested this last week, threw in some parameters, just generic parameters. And I gave AI, you know, ChatGPT parameters. And I said, write it in the style of an American search warrant affidavit. And it, not only was it in depth, accurate, and spot on, it was the language itself was over and beyond. I mean, I could have shortened it up a little bit. It nailed it, for lack of better terms, which is great. Of course, I read the whole thing and everything was validated, but I was like, well, heck, you know, we have a whole folder of search warrant templates for everything, almost every situation. Well, that's how we're writing search warrant templates. Well, if we don't have a law enforcement guide, some internet service providers don't provide their language. So you always have to just, you know, look at other ones that are similar, other ISPs similar to that, and just kind of Frankenstein, you know, your parameters and your affidavit to what they like. Because a few of them are very picky. If you don't ask a certain way, they're going to, you know, it's like the soup Nazi. They're going to, you know, from Seinfeld, they're going to kick you out.
Yeah.
Or they're not going to give you anything. But that was pretty cool. It was scary how spot on it was, but also it what it would take me 20 minutes to think of, it did it in, I mean, by the time I typed it and it was in front of me, 20 seconds. And that's perfect if you have the detective on the scene. You could punch it into your AI app on your phone. You got a portable printer with you, which aren't that large. It's smaller than a fishing tackle box.
Yeah.
You have it, write it out. You could just send it. I'm sure you could write something that goes to your actual, you know, states or local municipalities, you know, template. Boom, you got a search warrant for exactly what you want. That was pretty cool. I'll give AI that one. I'll use that again. I'm not going to lie to you on that one. That was pretty cool. So, and that is good. It does. And nobody's going to get you for, you know, the judge isn't going to run it through some sort of AI detection thing. Like, oh, this isn't you. This is it. It tested 98% for AI. No, nobody's going to do that. As long as the language is right. And then, you know, and you got all your facts, the who, what, where, when, and why, and how, boom, you're done. You know?
Yeah. It just comes back to what you were saying earlier. Validation.
Yeah.
You know, is it there? Is it not? Okay. Oh, it messed up on this. I need to go through and fix it. I need to, you know.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Now, I would not tell it in the parameters. All right. John Smith killed Jane Doe, you know, at 4400, Jones Street. He used a knife. I would not give AI specifics, because who knows where that information goes. So no,
yeah.
Keep it basic with, you know, just give it an idea of what you want. Do not throw in people's names or the gruesomeness of it. No. Be smart about it. Yeah. Don't give the whole story. Just give your parameters and you can fill in the blanks and, you know, augment it as you wish. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that. I'll make this comment. We don't have to discuss it, but Sam Altman was saying that right now you can only put in a certain amount into GPT to get it to give an output. Now it's like millions of lines or whatever, but he's looking forward to when you can put in trillions of lines of input. And he was talking about basically putting in your whole life story and everything you do on a daily basis so that the AI would truly know you. And he thought that was the greatest thing ever. And I'm sitting here thinking, I don't know if that's the greatest thing ever, but, when challenged on the privacy of the data, he kind of bobbed and weaved on it. So that made it even more sketchy. But, you know, one thing that I thought of that you were talking about with the warrant there is it'd be interesting coming the other direction as far as forensic tools, is forensic software being able to read your affidavit and your warrant and then construct search parameters and filters the content that you put in your affidavit and your warrant. Because then it's interesting, because you might say John Doe did such and killed mm-hmm. such and such at this, whatever. Well, it's going to be like, okay, so I'm going to filter by these mm-hmm. names for chats and whatever. I know a location, so I'm going to search my images and my chats for locations dealing with, let's say, 2 miles of that radius, you know, and then when your case loads in, okay, listen, you're still going to review all that, but at least maybe I have some hot picks here that I can start with. And I think, you know, as long as we get creative, we can we might have a nice little future there as long as we don't sacrifice that validation and that interpretation.
Yeah, and going to the privacy, I think if you had a standalone box offline software, you could punch in those numbers. I think, I don't know, but if you have software as a service running it, you know, that's going off to somebody's server, all that information. I don't know. So I don't think it would be too big of a deal with it. It's just a matter of, say you have a grand jury case, that grand jury's sealed, you know, nobody's supposed to know about it except for obviously the grand jury and the investigators running the case. So I think you could potentially run into problems with that if the information you are punching in is leaving your system and going somewhere else. Again, exactly. that's an issue for you and your prosecution. But I do believe that's a great parameter. That would be awesome, especially on the murder cases, you know, missing persons, you know, last seen at such and such location. Or also this, though, you can do it as, you know, my iPhone will tell me, you know, when I should go to Costco, when I should go to work, when I should go home. It knows my significant events. Do it where it can show the person's pattern of life, the phone user's pattern of life. You know, what they go, yeah. And you, I don't know what kind of graph you could make for it, but that would be incredible if you could do the last 30 days, what they did, you know, especially with bad guys. Everything's going to be up to the cloud or up in Google. If you got to tail somebody, if you got to find out, you know, where they go on certain days, if you just do, you know, search warrant to do live forensics on their cloud, obviously do get that order so they don't just, the judge or the ISP doesn't disclose it to them. Like, hey, they're looking at you. Just get that. And you can find out what they're doing. You can find out all their habits, their daily habits. So this way it makes surveillance a lot better, more efficient. And it's, I think that's something. I just thought about that right now. That was the first time it ever popped in my head. That's a good idea. Yeah. Anybody listening, come up with that idea. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. We're riffing right now. Come on. So, you know, here's an interesting thing that you're an examiner, you're an investigator, you're boots on the ground. You're the guy that's got to do it. That's where I was. I think, you know, guys like us think similar because we have to do it. Do you think there could be a possible, I'm going to use the word conflict, but that's pretty harsh, kind of a conflict between what a supervisor might want you to do with this technology and maybe what should be done from the investigator's point of view?
Yeah, if there's any conflict, it's because that supervisor has middle management, you know, it rolls downhill and it's also pushed uphill. And who do you have? You have middle management right here. So they're getting it on both ends, lack of better term. So if they get any pressure, it's because they're getting it from up top. And what up top wants are they want results as quick as possible. That unfortunately doesn't happen. Now you could, you know, feed them some stuff. That's why I said the AI triage would come in quick results, but it's a waste of resources and you're hindering an examiner's performance. If you just say, give me everything, here you go. You know, let us work for you. You know, if you don't need everything, if you just need like a 1 week period of time or just make the search small, that's what we like to do. You know, you like a good win. You like finding things on your own. You know, that's if you have any investigative skills or wants or anything like that, you know, as an examiner, you want to be able to dive into there and find things. You know, let us do our job, but I do understand it's also a pressure situation. You know, politics plays into it. Urgency obviously plays into it. That's the way of life. That happens whether you're stacking cabbages at a grocery store, you're a garbage man, you know, you work for a Fortune 500 company. It doesn't matter where you are. That's human nature. That's life. So you got to find that balance and try to, you know, take great notes. That's, you know, everybody loves it when you write detailed notes that shows what you're doing and why you're doing it. That's going to buy you some time, in my opinion. And that's, over time, you'll get a reputation. We'll like let him do his job. And I think that eases off. So, but yeah, note taking, documentation is key, is the zenith of police work. Write it down or it didn't happen. So yeah.
That's, you know, that provides us with a nice little segue to, you know, one of the things we talked about was what are some of the shortcuts that people, investigators can take in their workflows? But specifically, we talked about how that kind of comes through time, right?
And absolutely. And yeah.
If you know, we talked about what's the easiest way to get the information as kind of the approach. What are some of the shortcuts do you think that have stuck with you in your investigations that has really made life easier for you, other than documenting everything, which I think is a great first tip.
Yeah, and this comes through time. This comes actually through trial and error. You know, you know, any rookie investigator, anybody's going to try to cowboy you a little bit, and your chances are you fall on your face, which is good. You need that as long as you don't really destroy too much. But it's a great learning experience. But the easiest thing is just stick what you know, what's in front of you. Okay, your knowns. All right, we know this. We know this. All right, we have these findings. Stick with that. It's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. You just piece together, but you have your knowns, and what knowns you have are going to lead to more unknowns becoming knowns, and you just work through it, and eventually everything, all the pieces are going to come together. You may have a missing piece or two, but that's why you get a paycheck. You know, you're going to have to do some sweat equity into your investigation. But as long as you stick to, you know, your knowns and you focus on that instead of just like, well, we don't know this, we don't know that, it will eventually come together. As more pieces of the puzzle come together, you're going to get a bigger picture of what happened. It applies to, you know, your deputies or your investigators on the ground, as far as, and also in your lab doing the examinations. Just build on it. Don't panic. It's like baseball in the outfield. Your first step should always be back. Okay. If you charge after it, you're going to miss something. Take a step back. You're not on a hot scene. Chances are you are not on a hot scene. You got time. You know, take a step back, look at the overall picture, and just go from there. So, yeah.
The gap thing is really interesting to me, because I think in hindsight to my career or whatever, investigators who do both the lab work and the what I'll call the street work, I think have a big advantage over guys like me who are just in the lab, because a lot of times those gaps may not be filled digitally, right? You're going to go through their computer or their phone, and you're going to have this information. You're going to be like, oh, I don't know what happened here and here, but maybe that's physical evidence that's going to plug in there, or it's an interview, or it's whatever. And I think In my role, it was okay to get sucked totally into the digital, because that's all I did. I would take, you know, Waz's case, I would work the digital, build as many pieces as I could, and I would hand it back and say, all right, if there's any pieces missing in the jigsaw, fill it yourself, or tell me what digital relic might still be there. But I think that's one of the temptations, and you said take a step back, is we kind of get into this computer mode. And it's like, hey, you know, Waz, you're the computer guy. You get into that mode, and we can't let go of the physical police work, you know?
Yeah. Like, you know, I was a burglary detective before I'm doing what I'm doing. We didn't have Ring doorbells, blink cameras, anything. It was, I sound like I'm this like ornery old cop, but good old fashioned police work. You know, we mentioned about the maps and Google possibly going away. Well, people got investigated for murders and crimes way before cell phones were ever invented. I know we are an important tool. We are an important asset to any investigation. But also you got to have, you know, so is DNA. So is latent prints, almost any facet of law enforcement, any discipline, you know, that has to come together. And as we said, put together that big picture. If you rely solely on waiting for the examiner to give you all the evidence on the case, you're not beating down doors. You're not knocking on doors. You're not doing neighborhood canvasses, you know, the old school, you know, going to convenience stores, asking to see their, you know, surveillance, you know, footage and stuff like that. Right. For the most part, yeah, of course people do that, but you can't wait for us, you know, because like you said, it'll be a month before I could give you anything on it. So good old fashioned police work always helps out too as well. So, and then what we give you could supplement it. Yeah. And it could fill in the pieces of the puzzle. Absolutely. But like I said, people were convicted of murder in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and the 90s, without smartphones, and for the most part without computers. So it can still happen. Yeah.
You know, two things that popped in my head while you're saying that. One, what was taught to me very early when I was starting to get into it is digital forensics are alibi makers and they're alibi breakers.
Absolutely. Yes.
Very rarely. I mean, CSAM cases, you know, but very rarely are you the star of an investigation. Mm-hmm. You're a very important pillar, you know, that's holding up that platform. The other thing that I thought of As of the recording of this, the episode has not gone live, but I just interviewed, it will be once this one comes out, though. I just sat down with Bert Lyons of Medex Forensics. Have you ever looked into their stuff?
Briefly last year at IASIS and stuff like that, but that was about it. Okay. I'm not too well versed in them. Yeah.
So talked to him a lot. We talked about AI and synthetic media and all this sort of stuff. But the interesting thing that ties into what you just said, I think, is we kind of got into this mode where I tell you that something happened and Detective Wozniak's like, well, I'm going to look for a picture, a video, some digital mm-hmm. footprint that thing actually happened. Okay. And it's worked for a while now, but with all this synthetic media and increased security, we talked about encryption, we talked about that stuff. I think what we're going to see now is maybe a flip back to, hey, we have this picture, this video, or we have this phone, but we can't. Now, did anybody see it? Can we go talk to Justin? Yeah. Do we have I think we're going to kind of see a transition maybe. And so it's going to become more important than ever. And I think you said it earlier, to have that investigative mindset. You're going to need to know
absolutely
sources and how to talk to people and how to get information.
Absolutely. And again, comes full circle. You know, we talked about AI versus the human mind. Okay. It's the human judgment call, our creativity, our knowledge, our experience. That's going to work for us. So, knock on doors, you know, just, and that it's very simple. It's elementary, really. Just use all the tools and all your assets and the results of those assets to just help you along, guide you along the way. So it makes the overall investigation, it narrows the scope of the investigation for sure. Follow your strong points, I guess, and keep the weaker points on the back burner, but make sure you're still washing that pot so it doesn't boil over or dries up on you. That's who knows, you know, what am I? So
what are any of us? Yeah. So I want to wrap it back to IASIS kind of as we narrow in towards the end here, but you know, I'm going to ask a weird question. I did prep you. I will be what effect do you think all this automation, this AI, whatever we want to call it, large language models, this kind of, you know, forced on us, this rush to complete cases is going to have, what effect do you think that's going to have on like how we approach training and training organizations, if any?
I don't think it'll affect it too much because not in the short term. I don't see that. I think I see us and most training organizations staying the course. You know, you can't ignore the elephant in the room, but how are you going to, you can't really train for it. It's better just to stay the course and weather the storm, I guess, you know, hit the wave head on. I'm not speaking for IASIS training unit or anything like that. I'm just spitballing here from what I see and what I would want, because you still have to have, again, as we talked, you got to have the fundamentals, you got to have the training, you got to have the knowledge. It's okay to, you know, use these tools, but I mean, it's space shuttle astronaut, you know, that space shuttle is probably flying itself, but you're still going to have to know how to control that stick on reentry, you know, and keep everything stable. You know, the same concept applies. So you just, you know, teach what needs to be taught and learn what needs to be learned and apply it. And everything else will come into place. You're going to have some gravy with the AI and the softwares. And that's great. Absolutely. 100% fantastic. But then everybody who teaches at IASIS are, you know, experts in the fields that they're teaching too. So, you know, they're not going to get some guy who, you know, cooks macaroni all day at the, you know, spaghetti warehouse and come in and teach it, you know, fat file systems. No, these are people that are working on it. You know, everybody's, that's their day job. So they're constantly, you know, ongoing training, you know, just through their job alone and own research. So by the time they come to teach, you know, they're boned up on all the current trends and techniques and education readings and what have you not. So they could pass it on to their students. And that's what makes it so great with IASIS, is the diversity of all the expertise and people in their fields. So, and all volunteer organization, everybody, you know, it's more work sometimes to volunteer for IASIS than it is to actually do your job, especially this time of year, but it's well worth it. Well worth it. So.
No, I think, you know, people should check out the first time we got together on a podcast, because I think we talked about how teaching is not as easy as some people think it is.
It's not, but I'll tell you, I taught mobile device forensics for 2 years, and I learned more teaching myself how to teach mobile device forensics than I ever learned in any class, because you force yourself You know, when your head is on the platter, you know, you're going to learn real quick. You know, you're going to learn. And it's a pressure situation, but you know, pressure is what builds diamonds. So it forces you to really get in there. And it's very rewarding when it's all said and done with too. So it's a great professional growth and education is a force yourself to learn that crap. Now, I'm not saying you're going to jump into it out of nowhere and start reading books on it. Maybe you could, but you take the foundation of what you have, you build on it. And when you have to actually put together a curriculum, you know, and I'm not an instructor or I should say a school teacher or anything like that, but we have to put together a curriculum detailed, write a white paper and submit it. And you're not used to that. That's a learning experience for both the instructor. And then of course you got to pass that on. You know, and ISIS approves it, they approve it, then you're teaching. That's it. So yeah, and then you gotta figure out how to portray it to 50 to 300 students, depending on your class size. Yeah.
I think teaching is the best way to learn in that the preparation you talked about, but also you're going to have X amount of students in there that all have a different question, mm-hmm. a different thought, a different workflow, a different life experience. And all of a sudden, I mean, there probably wasn't many classes that went by where somebody wouldn't ask something. And you're like, I've never thought about it that way. Yep. And then you're having to either figure it out yourself or you're like, I mean, I've had it where it's like, well, I don't know. Yeah. I can get back to you. That's a great question. Still happens today. And so, you know, teaching, sharing, even if it's not an official teaching, just sharing the knowledge that you have is always going to be that learning thing and interacting with the community. And
you'll always have, especially in the certification classes, you'll always have somebody in the room, a student who is smarter than you. You know, they're in that class because they want the certification or their job wants them to get a certification. But I don't know who came up with this saying, but and I agree with it. If you are the smartest man in the room, you're in the wrong room, you know? So it's great being an instructor. You have people that are smarter than you. Number one, that forces you to elevate your game a little bit more. Number two, it teaches you, it humbles you a little bit because this person does more. And then when they interject, embrace it. Let them roll with it. You know, they're not being rude. Yeah. They're just adding great content to your stuff. Yeah. Number one, it buys you time. So you're just trying to get to that 45, 50 minute mark to the next break because you went through your PowerPoint too quick. But so yeah, it works out. It's a win-win for everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, when I first started way back at Access Data Contract Instructing, it wasn't that I, you know, didn't want people to comment. I did. But when you're new, you feel like somehow because Waz is in this class and he's smarter than me and making comments that the other students are going to think less of me. But I've never thought that as a person in a class. Yeah. And I think most people just view it as, hey, we're all here. Like, let's share, you know, this guy's here to guide us and yes, deliver information. But like when I would go to training and when I still do, it's like, I want my money's worth.
Oh, 100%. Or I want my time's worth. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. And, you know, that's IASIS. When you said you got 700 to 800 students walking around plus 200 plus staff, and then even, you know, I want to bring us vendors into it because a lot of the vendor guys that are there and gals are former investigators.
Oh,
former,
absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and so everybody crawling around there causing trouble knows something about forensics. Yes. And so there's always something to learn. And so ISIS is the worth trip for sure.
Yeah. Students, I like it obviously because I get to roam the hallways when the students are in class. So I get first dibs at swag. It's great networking for everybody. It's a win-win networking. The students get to network with not only the instructors themselves and the vendors. The vendors get to network. That's how you and I came together. Vendors get to, you know, network with vendors. And it's a full Venn diagram of networking, you know, with that one, you know, that center core. And it's everybody wins from it. So it's a great, I don't know how long it is before everybody just gets, instead of business cards, we're just walking around with QR codes on our lanyards and just sitting there, everybody's just taking snaps, just snapping pictures of each other. And it goes right to your contact list. So
I'll be real with you. I have been trying to get my company to buy me. It's called Link, LINQ, but there's a bunch of different ones. And that's what I want.
Yeah.
I want that. Like either a QR code or an NFC chip.
Yep.
Because
I saw that.
Man, I've had contacts give me business cards, and I appreciate it, and I have every intention of whatever, but they just disappear at a conference.
You they know? Do. It goes in whatever book bag the conference gives you, with the pens, the squishy globe stress ball, and then you know it goes to your office, and then it just you know they sit and then they sit, you know. Or I got a pile of business cards like that from people that I never go through, you know, because it's just easier to ask for somebody's phone number. You're going to find them on LinkedIn or you know, and there's always a class list, you know, so you're always going to have that. Yeah. So I think something like that would be more efficient and more productive, especially if you could go, you take a picture, shoot something like that, and it goes right to your contact list. You know, that's the way to go. They should do that as well as that thing I said about building somebody's 30-day history right there for you. Those are a lot of ideas coming here. I gotta write these down. I know.
So when that day comes that you retire from law enforcement sometime in the future, you go out, start your own thing of, you'll do two things, build 30-day histories and sell business cards.
I need the Michael Scott, like the recorder when he comes up with his great ideas. Yeah. So I'll start with that. It'll be in my garage. Jeff Bezos did it. I can do it. And we'll build from there. Yeah. I'll start selling books and then tea kettles and then whatever, you know? Yeah. So just go from there. Just expand.
Exactly. I mean, sounds like a plan to me.
Yep.
Well, awesome. Hey, anything you want to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, real quick. So we talked a little bit about push button forensics and AI, and I punched in today. I asked ChatGPT, tell me how it's needed for the necessity of humans and digital forensics as opposed to relying on AI. And it sent me out this. Now, these are notes I made. I had to abbreviate everything. I should have said in the style of bullet points. It wrote me a term paper version of it. I don't know if the kids today still say term paper, a college paper on it. It was incredible. And I knew most of the points. I was like, yeah. But a few of them, I was like, you know what? That's a good point. And then I did the same thing with push button forensics. And it wrote me a college paper on push button forensics, which I had to shorten up a little bit just for, you know, bullet points while I'm reading it. And it was quite fascinating. The funny thing is that AI agreed with me and said that, you know, humans over AI. The only thing I'm worried about is that AI knows I made it do that, and I'm on a list somewhere now with AI. So, you know, because it's going to remember, oh, this guy's cocky. And, you know, 10 years down the line when Skynet's here, I gotta figure out some sort of contrition to get back on its good side. Cause I know I'm on a list or they're watching me. So, but it was quite ingenious. It was a great, it pushed out some nice stuff in favor of humans. It wasn't like, no, you want to use AI. No, it had very good points on it. It was very in depth. I should have said in the style of bullet points, that would have been a little bit better. Maybe I'll try that tomorrow. And I'll let you know. It'll do it. I mean, I know it'll do it, but that was a fun little experiment during our AI episode. So AI episode. I always get AI and IA, you know, internal investigations. Not like I'm ever part of one, but those are,
You know, when you get that random HR invite on your calendar. So
Yeah.
Well, cool. You know, I want to thank you again and thank you for giving me the opportunity to chat with you and in prep for IASIS. I know this episode will come out sometime before IASIS conference in end of April, beginning of May. But as it stands right now, I'm not sure the date. You and I have to coordinate that.
That works.
And we'll get on that. But, you know, again, thanks for this. And we're always looking forward to IASIS. And, you know, thanks for all you guys do.
Absolutely. And quick plug, your socks. Make sure you bring the socks. I'm wearing them today. I do not want to show my limit range of flexibility and throw my leg up there to show the socks. They are fantastic socks. And trust me, I am wearing them today. I sent you a picture today of them with the nice shoes I got for Christmas and what have you not. Extremely comfortable and effective socks. So good color scheme to them and everything like that. But we'll be seeing you. Look forward to it. And thanks for having me on or being on with, you know, since this is, we're both going to be publishing this. It's always a pleasure. It's great for viewership and audience. So. Looking forward to it. Always a great talk, Justin.
Cool. Thank you.
Yes, sir.